I don't mean to sound negative this morning, but this subject is of the glory departing. Our discussions this weekend surround the important and very interesting prophecies of Ezekiel, titled The Typical Son of Man. Ezekiel was one of the three great prophets of the terrible period of the destruction of Yahweh's kingdom. He conducted his ministry as a prophet, not in Israel, but in the land of Chaldea or Babylon. He had been carried away from the land with the thousands of the Jews who went into exile. This period began the Gentile times. The kingdoms of men of which we are now living at the closing time. Three prophets who ministered at this time period were Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and Daniel. Jeremiah and Daniel were both of the priestly line and ministered respectively to the Jews in Babylon and to the Jews in Judea and Jerusalem. Daniel was of the royal line and served in the Babylonian and later in the Persian courts. All these had vital work to do for Yahweh's people. It is clear that Daniel was providentially raised to high authority both in the Babylonian and the Persian governments to protect the interests of Yahweh's people, much as Esther and Mordecai were a little later, and Nehemiah, who was the cupbearer to the king. All this was just over 2,500 years ago at the beginning of the seven times, or 2,520 years of the Gentiles, in the last years of which we now live. For nearly 7 years, Ezekiel's message was one of warning of the impending judgment of Almighty Yahweh upon Zedekiah and the people of Israel that were still in the land. The first chapters lead up to the worst events in Israel's history, the departure of the glory of the Lord from the temple, as is marked in Ezekiel chapter 10. The glory of Yahweh was never to return for over 2,500 years until the erection of the millennial temple that Ezekiel describes in his last nine chapters. This chapter 10 is part of the vision that extends from chapter 8 through chapter 11. The vision was in the sixth year of Zedekiah, the last king of Judah, just about 3.5 years before the final Babylonian siege in which the city was taken and destroyed. The glory of Yahweh, the Shekinah presence between the cherubim over the mercy seat in the Most Holy, had to be removed before the temple and city were destroyed. The temple was rebuilt and restored after the 70-year Babylonian exile. The temple was there, but the glory did not return. The temple was again rebuilt at the urgings of the prophet Haggai. There were high priests and temple services in the days of Nehemiah and the restoration period, but the glory had departed. There was Herod's temple in Christ's day, which he called my father's house, but the glory still had not returned, either to the royal throne or to the priesthood. Ezekiel said in chapter 21, "Remove the diadem and take off the crown. It shall be no more until he come whose right it is." The word here, translated diadem, refers to the high priest's headdress or the mitre. Apart from here, this word only occurs in Exodus and Leviticus, and it is always translated mitre and always applied to the headdress of the high priest. The high priest in Nehemiah's day was a wicked politician in league with the enemy, as were the priests in Christ's day. Truly, they sat in Moses' seat, but they were a generation of vipers. Yahweh's glory was not in their Herod-built temple. And truly Yahweh said to Haggai of the temple rebuilt under Zerubbabel in the return from Babylon, the glory of this latter house shall be greater than the former, and in this place will I give peace. But Yahweh also says when and how this will be accomplished, when he says, I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory. That day we know is yet to come. We know when the glory will return, because Ezekiel, who saw it leave, also saw it return in prophetic vision by the way of the east gate into the glorious house of prayer for all nations, as he describes in his closing chapters. The vision we are studying here begins in chapter 8. This is Zedekiah's sixth year, because it is the sixth year of Jehoiachin's captivity, and Zedekiah followed Jehoiachin on the throne. Ezekiel is in Babylon with the captives. But the Spirit of Yahweh lifts him up and takes him in vision to the temple in Jerusalem. And he is shown there four abominations. Verse 5 of chapter 8, the image of jealousy, an abominable idol in Yahweh's holy place. And Yahweh says in verse 6, seest thou what they do, even the great abominations that the house of Israel committeth here, that I should go far off from my sanctuary? Yahweh is showing the prophet Ezekiel why the glory is to depart, and to explain to the remnant left in Babylon for both their warning and for their comfort why the glory is to leave the temple and the nation and the city was to be destroyed. Next, in verses 3, 7 to 13, and he brought me to the door of the court, and when I looked, behold, a hole in the wall. And he said unto me, go in, and behold the wicked abominations that they do here. So I went in and saw, and behold, every form of creeping things and abominable beasts, and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed upon the wall round about. And there were stood before them 70 men of the ancients of the house of Israel, and in the midst of them stood Joazaniah the son of Shaphan, with every man his censer in his hand. And a thick cloud of incense went up. Then said he unto me, son of man, hast thou seen what the ancients of the house of Israel do in the dark, every man in the chambers of his imagery? For they say, the Lord seeth us not. The Lord hath forsaken us, that has forsaken the earth. He said also unto me, turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations that they do. Ezekiel saw 70 men of the ancients of the house of Israel performing abominable idols, idolatries in the temple. Here is the top rulership of the land, the 70 elders, which shows the nation's hopelessly corrupt condition. And next, in verses 14 to 15, then he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north. And behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. Then said he unto me, hast thou seen this, O son of man? Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations than these. He saw women weeping for the heathen idol, Tammuz. And next, in verses 16 to 17, he saw 25 men with their backs to the temple, worshiping the sun right at the door of the temple. And he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 and 20 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east, and they worshiped the sun toward the east. Then he said unto me, hast thou seen this, O son of man? Is it a light thing to the house of Judah that they commit the abominations which they commit here? For they have filled the land with violence and have returned to provoke me to anger. Now we are told at each step that the succeeding abomination is worse, worse than the one before. Why the women should be considered worse than the 70 leading elders of the nation, we're not told. But we do know that there were very vile rites performed in connection with this idol Tammuz, a Babylonian fertility cult notorious for its lewd practices with women in the heathen temples. The idol Tammuz had become so interwoven with Israel's captivity that it was adopted as a month of the Jewish calendar, a reminder of their captivity. Tammuz was the idol Ishtar's consort or husband. When Tammuz died in the summer and all vegetation died with him, Ishtar was looking for him all over the world. She finally found him in the underworld and brought him back to life. Tammuz was reborn, and the vegetation could flourish again. Then the ritual festival of the holy marriage was celebrated at the time of the autumn equinox, when in the Near East the first rain fell again. The women in the temple were weeping in celebration of the ancient custom of Ishtar, the heathen fertility goddess, later to be known among the successive empires as Venus, Aphrodite, and in Paul's day as Diana of the Ephesians. Women had no place in the temple worship and were clearly an abomination in the sight of Yahweh. The 25 men that he saw last are the climax. They could be and probably represent the leaders of the 24 courses of the priesthood plus the high priest. And if this is so, it could explain why in Yahweh's sight this is the worst of all. This was at the inner court, right at the door of the temple, where none but the priests were ever allowed to go. This again indicates that it was the priest involved. It was not until the time of Ahaz, the father of Hezekiah, that the actual temple itself was profaned with idolatry. Hezekiah destroyed this and cleansed the temple. It was brought back again even more wickedly by his son Manasseh and his son Amon. Then came Josiah, who again cleansed the temple and the land. But as soon as Josiah was dead, it came back in full flood. Of the last four kings, Josiah's three sons and his grandson all were wicked, and the land was increasingly corrupt. Incredibly, these people still considered themselves Yahweh's special nation. They were offered sacrifices to Yahweh and were perfectly confident that since Abraham was accepted and that he inherited the land, and because we are many, the land is given us for inheritance. Their reasoning is clear in their own eyes. If Yahweh so richly blessed one special person, Abraham, just think how confident they could be as a whole nation of Yahweh's special people. Before Ezekiel began his work, he was warned of the difficulty of his task. He was told, "For they are impudent." The Hebrew means hard of face. They are impudent children and stiff-hearted. To emphasize the point, the warning was immediately repeated. "But the house of Israel will not hearken unto thee, for they will not hearken unto me. For all the house of Israel are impudent and hard-hearted." The Hebrew is stiff of forehead, or hard of heart. They are hard, having been thoroughly hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. The last phrase is familiar because it comes from in Hebrews chapter 3, verse 13, as part of an exhortation to the followers of Christ. Hearts hardened by sin were not unique in the Jews of Ezekiel's day. The condition has always been prevalent, and even now is a serious danger for us. We need to be fully aware that human beings can become hardened to the most shocking circumstances. Soldiers in wartime experience the effect as they are sickened at the first battle casualty they witness, but gradually become hardened to seeing death all around. Many medical professionals couldn't do their jobs unless they become somewhat desensitized to the suffering that they must deal with. This characteristic is actually essential as we raise a family and clean up messes which used to nauseate us. The problem is when we become hardened to sin. Some have experienced the numbing effect of continued exposure to vulgarity in the workplace. At first, we are appalled. Then we get used to it and don't react, and hopefully we will not get drawn into it ourselves. It is a known phenomenon that children become desensitized to violence by what they see on TV and the movies. Note the point, they become hardened by just watching violence. That's because they empathetically associate themselves with the characters being viewed and to some extent live out what they are watching. A brother recently answered some ideas about attending the worldly depiction of the crucifixion of Christ. There was a time when such actions were so alien to the household of faith, they would not get a mention amongst the brethren and sisters. We should not encourage our friends into believing we are at ease about attending such occasions. It sends a message that Christadelphians are relaxing their standards and opening the floodgates to the world's entertainments, provided there is some mention of the Bible topic. Brother Grocott and the pioneers would be horrified at this trend. We should not lower our standards to this. A young person, after viewing this movie, told me last week that they had seen worse violence in movies and on TV. At first, the TV or movie is the invited guest into the home and is very charming and informative, as a brother recently recounted, and it is quickly to be seen void of scriptural understanding and anything profitable in the ways of Yahweh. It is not only children who have this quality of empathy, that is, the capacity for participating in the feelings of others, another. We all have it, to a greater or lesser degree extent. When the characters sin, the viewers do as well. Remembering Christ's words about whosoever looketh upon a woman to lust after her, all of which means the more we entertain ourselves with TV and the movies, the more we face the potential of hardening our hearts by the deceitfulness of sin. This is a spiritual danger, if not spiritual suicide. The combination of free time and universal access to TV, videos, movies, and internet has a frightening potential for hardening our hearts. And all this is available for our private viewing anytime, day or night. We must avail ourselves of the truth by the daily reading of His Word, the pioneer works, and study to turn our faces toward the glory that is to come. Chapter 9 continues this vision. We know that this is not an actual event at this time, but a vision or a representation. It was fulfilled, generally speaking, 5 years later when the Babylonians broke into the city. In this chapter, the judgments on the idol worshippers are portrayed. In verse 1, he cried also in mine ears with a loud voice, saying, cause them that have charge over the city to draw near, even every man with his destroying weapon in his hand. The He who speaks to Ezekiel all through this vision is the manifestation of Yahweh that Ezekiel saw above the cherubim in verse 1, in chapter 1. This manifestation appears to him at the beginning of this current vision in chapter 8, verse 2. Then I beheld a likeness as the appearance of fire, from his loins downward fire, and from his loins upward brightness. The fire of judgment for those cast down for wickedness, and the brightness of glory for those exalted for righteousness. As we begin chapter 9, this personage the manifestation of Yahweh, calls for the custodians for the city of Jerusalem to come forth with their slaughter weapons, whereupon in verse 2, six armed men appear. History tells us that the agency Yahweh was about to use for this judgment was the Babylonian army. The number six points to it being of human agency and is even more specific in its execution when we note that when the destroying Babylonian army broke into the city just 5 years after this vision, as Jeremiah records in his chapter 39, verse 3, that six princes or generals of the king of Babylon entered and sat in the middle gate to oversee the operation. Six men with slaughter weapons, for they were the heads of the army. But in this vision, there is a seventh man portraying the divine side of the picture. He is clothed in linen for righteousness and carries a writing instrument. Before the destroyers are allowed to begin their mission, this man is instructed in verse 4, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that are done in the midst thereof. There is nothing haphazard about the operations of Yahweh. He overlooks nothing, and he makes no mistakes. No one true grain of corn is ever allowed to fall to the ground and with the sifted out chaff. There is great comfort in this man with the writer's inkhorn. Anyone looking at the events in Jerusalem with natural eyes would never have dreamed that Yahweh was carefully watching and controlling what happened to every individual. But we note that the only ones spared were those who sighed and cried for the abominations. Sighing refers to internal feeling. Crying is an external manifestation of sorrow. The word here for sigh is also translated mourn and groan. Blessed are ye that mourn. There are many words in Hebrew for cry, but the one here is always associated with suffering and mourning. It is that type of crying. It was not enough to just refrain from these abominations. People who are neutral are no good to Yahweh or man. There had to be a complete separation from the abominations and from those who committed them, and a mourning and crying out against them to be spared by Yahweh in this terrible day of judgment upon Jerusalem. Neutrals, or those who are lukewarm, are never safe and never get any joy or satisfaction out of life. As Brother Grocott said, to please God and to have joy in life, we must be enthusiastically all the way over on the side of goodness and righteousness. The things of God are so great and so marvelous that there is nothing more pitiful or more unreasonable than a half-hearted Christadelphian. The righteous mourners, having been marked for protection, the order goes forth in verses 5 to 6, go through the city and smite. Let not your eye spare, neither have ye pity. Slay utterly old and young, and begin. Begin at my sanctuary. This vision is representative and not actual. We are not to suppose that when the Babylonians broke into the city, they killed all the wicked and spared all the righteous. We are being shown Yahweh's ultimate judgments. Actually, we're given the picture that the righteous had already been taken out of the city and taken to Babylon. In this way, they are marked in the forehead, and they were separated beforehand from the idolaters. This is shown in the prophecy of Jeremiah's two baskets of figs. The good are taken away and the rotten are left in the city. This was the general picture of Yahweh's deliverance of his true people at this time, but it was not obvious to the natural eye. It looked like those in the city were the favored ones, and those carried into slavery and into captivity were the unfavored ones. It had to be not obvious to the natural eye, or there would be no exercise of faith. Jeremiah suffered and died along with the wicked remnant, because that was the work that Yahweh appointed for him to do. In verse 7, and he said unto them, unto the six men with the slaughter weapons, defile the house, defile the house. The house is the temple of Yahweh. And then he says, and fill the courts with the slain. The house or temple was already thoroughly defiled by the abominations committed there. Yahweh was now about to confirm that defilement by filling it with the slain bodies of the defilers. The glory was about to depart from the polluted sanctuary. Back in verse 3, before the beginning of these judgments, is the first indication of the departure of the Shekinah glory of the presence of Yahweh that had dwelt so long over the mercy seat between the cherubim. And the glory of the Yahweh Elohim of Israel was gone up from the cherub to the threshold of the house. The glory left the most holy place and paused at the doorway. We note that it departs slowly and very reluctantly and in four distinct stages, showing Yahweh's sorrow and his mercy, giving every opportunity for some indication of repentance to reform. But there was none. The truth is about redemption and forgiveness. And Yahweh goes to great length to show mercy and kindness to those who are of a right heart. Punishment is a last step and is best left in the hands of him who knows the hearts and minds of his called out ones. The cherub or cherubim mentioned in chapter 9, verse 3, refers to the golden cherubim in the most holy place from which the Shekinah glory is leaving. This is the first phase of the departure. And the glory of Yahweh Elohim of Israel was gone up from the cherub whereupon he was to the threshold of the house, and he called to the man clothed with linen, which had the writer's inkhorn by his side. As chapter 10 begins, the vision of the cherubim and the sapphire throne of glory that Ezekiel first saw in chapter 1 at the beginning of his ministry now reappear. It is, of course, the same cherubim as the golden cherubim of the ark, but the cherubim Ezekiel saw in vision are far more detailed. They are active and alive. In fact, life and activity are their principal characteristics. They are the living ones, the living creatures. They are represented as having constant, rapid, lightning-like motion and ceaseless activity. They are more fully described back in chapter 1. In a large way, chapter 10 is a brief repetition of the details of chapter 1. Ezekiel first saw a storm and clouds coming from the north in chapter 1, verse 4. And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud and fire enfolding itself, and the brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof is the color of amber out of the midst of the fire. Our brothers previously mentioned about amber and its significance. These are the judgments coming upon Jerusalem. Out of them came fire, and out of the fire come the cherubim. They are fourfold. They are basically in human form, with a human face at the front. But each of the four has three other faces, one on each side and one at the back, a lion, an ox, and an eagle beside their man's face. And they also each have four wings and calved feet, and they have hands under their wings. They are arranged in a square with their backs inwards and each facing outwards in a different direction. Under each one is a wheel so formed as to be able to roll in any of the four directions without turning. Together they form a chariot, the chariot of the cherubim. They are the vehicle and the dwelling place and the instrument of Yahweh. Brother Thomas has very beautifully demonstrated that the cherubim are a pictorial representation of the memorial name, Yahweh Elohim, He who will be mighty ones. Yahweh manifested in a glorious multitude of whom Christ is the center and the head. In their general description and their number, four, and their names as the living ones, they are identified with the four living ones in the book of Revelation. In their name as cherubim, they are identified as the guardians of the Garden of Eden, the golden cherubim that overshadowed the mercy seat, typified Christ, the cover of the Ark of the Testimony. The aspect of light and motion comes out very clearly in the description of them in chapter 1, verse 4. The fire enfolding itself, that is, in constant but controlled movement. Verses 13 to 14, the appearance of the living creatures was like burning coals of fire and like the appearance of lamps or torches. The fire went up and down among the living creatures, and out of the fire went forth lightning, and the living creatures ran and returned as the appearance of a flash of lightning. Lightning travels at the speed of light and electricity. It is still the fastest motion known in the natural universe that we can observe. There are other theories in science of faster speeds in the makeup of the atomic nucleus. Besides motion, there is tremendous brilliance and glory, like ceaseless lightning flashes. In verse 24, their noise was like the voice of many of mighty ones, the noise of great waters, the noise of a host. On the Mosaic Tabernacle and the Solomon Temple, they rested, golden and motionless, and the glory of Yahweh rested quietly upon them. This is the ideal state of peace with Yahweh. It does not indicate, however, any lessening of a living activity, for these are still the living ones that rest not day and night from their worshiping and glorifying Yahweh as they are described in Revelation chapter 4. But it does indicate the absence of their militant activity. When they rested, they let down their wings, and when they were silent. The cherubim in Ezekiel's visions, however, are aroused. They have a terrible work to perform in the earth, beginning at the Jerusalem and the sanctuary of Yahweh. The primary application was the destruction of Jerusalem, the breaking up of the nation, and a scattering and slaying of the people. But in the future, it has an application to the judgment which are to come upon the earth in the last days of Yahweh's wrath. Most of the saints throughout the past 2,500 years are still in the graves awaiting judgment and resurrection and judgment. They are awaiting the glory that will be bestowed upon them and therefore can be styled as part of the living creatures. Of this same picture of the judgments upon Jerusalem. All live unto him. All things are for their sakes. All things are in answer to the prayers of the righteous. Similarly, we find the living creatures in the Revelation directing the judgments upon Rome, both pagan and papal. If we are the true children of Yahweh, and we can be if we are prepared to give our lives wholly and unreservedly to him, then the whole course of human history is but working out our ultimate and welfare and our glory, the glory of the cherubim. There is no other purpose at all for our existence. Our glory is for and to the glory of Yahweh. As chapter 10 begins, the throne and cherubim appear again to Ezekiel. And the likeness on the throne told the man in linen to take fire from between the cherubim and scatter it over the city of Jerusalem. Then I looked, and behold, in the firmament that was above the head of the cherubim, there appeared over them, as it were, a sapphire stone, as the appearance of the bright likeness of a throne. And he spake unto the man clothed with linen and said, Go in between the wheels, even under the cherubim, and fill thine hand with coals of fire from between the cherubim, and scatter them over the city. And he went in my sight. Here the punishment of Jerusalem is connected with the cherubim. The punishments are meted out from them. The cherubim were standing in verse 3. Now the cherubim stood on the right side of the house, and the man went in, and the cloud filled the inner court. The house or temple faced east. The right side was the south side. Right and south are always associated in the Hebrew, and the left side was the north, the north side. Note that all the way through chapter 8, the abominations were on the north, or left-hand side, the sheep on the right hand, and the goats, or the rejected, on the left side. The cherubim were on the right side, the south side, or the sheep gate. In chapters 10, verse 4, then the glory Yahweh went up from the cherub and stood over the threshold of the house, and the house was filled with the cloud, and the court was full of the brightness of Yahweh's glory. This appears to be a repetition of chapter 9, verse 3, but the wording is a little different. Lifted up, as we see in the margin, instead of gone up, and over instead of to, in relation to the threshold. Clearly, it is the next step, or the second phase, of the departure, in the sad departure of Yahweh's glory from Israel. It begins to be lifted up and taken away from them. In verse 5, and the sound of the cherubim's wings was heard even to the outer court as the voice of the El Shaddai when he speaketh. This is the strength of the powerful ones, El manifested through the ministers of deity, according to Brother Thomas. This is the very sad part. The outer court was the court of the Gentiles. Jeremiah said, in Lamentations, which is Jeremiah's description of this very time, all mine enemies have heard of my troubles, and they are glad. And Jeremiah says of this time, in Jeremiah 22, verse 8, many nations shall say, Wherefore hath Yahweh done this unto this great city? Then they shall answer, Because they have forsaken the covenant of the Lord. The sound of the cherubim's wings was heard even to the outer court. Israel was chosen to be a select and called out race for Yahweh. Their conduct either glorified or shamed him before all the nations. They could not be neutral. From their very position, we should remember that we are in the same position. We are called out ones and privileged to have an opportunity of uniting ourselves in his glorious purpose. We can either bring glory or dishonor upon his name by our conduct in the sight of the world, the outer court. And because Israel did not have the wisdom to be a faithful witness to Yahweh's glory, they had to be made a witness to his wrath and of his righteous judgment. Once they had been brought specially close to Yahweh, they could no longer be neutrals or escape from their great responsibility. We have been called near. We cannot run away and hide from Yahweh. There is no going back. It is a tragedy when the sins and follies of Yahweh's people give the heathen occasion to reproach and rejoice. That was the sad legacy that befell King David. His sin caused the enemies of Yahweh to reproach his word. In verses 18 to 19, we see the third phase of the departure. Then the glory of Yahweh departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim, and the cherubim lifted up their wings and mounted up from the earth in my sight. When they went out, the wheels were beside them, and they stood at the door of the east gate of Yahweh's house, and the glory of the Yahweh Elohim of Israel was above them. The glory of Yahweh withdraws still further from the threshold to the outer east gate. It is leaving by the way of the east. The cherubim departs with it, like the people of Yahweh being taken out of Sodom. Chapter 11 is still part of the vision. In verses 22 to 23, the cherubim and the glory leave the city entirely and stand on the Mount of Olives to the east of the city, the fourth and the final phase of its departure. So the cherubim lifted up their wings with the wheels beside them, and the glory of the Yahweh of Israel was high above them, and the glory of the Lord went up from the midst of the city and stood on the mountain, which is on the east side of the city. At this point, Ezekiel is taken back to Chaldea, and he does not see the glory ascend from the Mount of Olives. Perhaps there is a significance and promise in this. The Lord's glory has withdrawn itself from the city, but we know he is never far from it, even in its desolation. The question for us is, have we let the glory of Yahweh's word depart from our lives? It was from the Mount of Olives that Jesus approached the city for his last visit, which ended in his rejection and death. While they sang, "Blessed is the King that cometh in the name of the Lord," he wept for the city, for he knew the sad reality that faced his beloved city 40 years later. And just under 7 weeks later, it was from this same spot, the Mount of Olives, that he ascended to heaven. The true living glory of Yahweh, rejected by the people, was withdrawn, that the city might again be destroyed and be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. In chapter 43, in the middle of his description of the new temple to be built, the house of prayer for all nations, Ezekiel was allowed to see the glory return in vision. In chapter 43, starting at verse 2, "And behold, the glory of the Yahweh of Israel came from the way of the east, and his voice was like a noise of many waters. And the earth shined with his glory, and it was according to the appearance of the vision which I saw, even according to the vision that I saw when I came to destroy the city. And the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate, whose prospect is toward the east. So the Spirit took me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house. And he said unto me, Son of man, the place of my throne, where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever, and my holy name shall the house of Israel no more defile, neither they nor their kings." This is the vision of the cherubim and the sapphire throne and the rainbow and the coming of Christ as the glory of the Lord. And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives. And he shall come as the King of glory to the welcoming gates of Jerusalem, which thenceforth shall be the holy city. For from that day its name shall be The Lord is there. Lo, he comes, the King of glory. See the royal victor's brow. Once for sinners marred and gory, Jesus is exalted now. While before him all his ransomed brethren bow.